On this episode of the Real Life Pharmacology Podcast, I'm going to cover mirtazapine, which the brand name is Remeron. Now, this drug, how it works is it blocks alpha-2 receptors within the central nervous system, or it's an antagonist, and this can ultimately increase norepinephrine and serotonin release. Now, this mechanism is slightly different from serotonin reuptake inhibitors and SNRIs, like serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors. So it does work slightly differently. One other thing with the mechanism that's unique, and I'll talk a little bit about the side effects with the medication as well, but mirtazapine can block H1 receptors, so that means it has antihistamine activity and can give it some sedative type properties, which I'll talk about a little bit more as I'm getting into the side effects. Now, thinking about, you know, kind of how the drug works, what it's acting upon in the central nervous system, we can probably theorize that this drug is going to be indicated for the use of depression, treating depression, and certainly it is. With the adverse effect profile of sedation, this drug is often used for insomnia as well. And because of that antihistamine effect, we may also see some weight gain. Now, that can definitely be problematic in some patients, let's say a type 2 diabetic who's overweight already, or, you know, younger females and males that have been gaining weight. You know, that's a big problem, a potential adverse effect that's significant. In our geriatric patient population, if we have trouble with patients who are anorexic, they have trouble eating, really have poor appetite, things like that, this is a reason why you might see this medication utilized. Now, I would say in my practice, what I've seen as a pharmacist, I would say most often it's used for patients who present with depression and, let's say, poor appetite, for example. So those are some of the uses that I think you're going to see mirtazapine used for most. Let's get into those side effects a little bit more, because I think they're really, really important, and mechanistically, you can understand how these kind of crop up. So that first one we talked about a little bit, the H1 receptors and blocking that activity. So think of older generation antihistamines like diphenhydramine or hydroxyzine. They're very, very sedating medications. So that mechanism with mirtazapine can also occur as well. So sedation, you definitely have to educate patients about that. The weight gain, using it to actually stimulate appetite, you may see that in geriatric patients, but certainly that can be a negative in younger patients and patients who are already overeating or obese or overweight. That's definitely a negative thing there for sure. I have seen rare instances of, you know, different CNS changes, confusion, hallucination, worsening symptoms of anxiety or depression. So certainly, I always think of any drug that basically acts on the central nervous system, there's always a potential, however great or small, that it's going to impact our patients negatively sometimes. So again, pretty rare that I've seen any issues that way, but certainly something to think about if the timing of starting or increasing the dose of the medication correlates with any type of new symptoms. Now, that sleep effect, you'll see it written and seen and in different articles and things like that, that lower doses maybe tend to be more sedating than higher doses, and that's due to that kind of antihistamine effect at lower doses. As we get to higher doses, there may be more of a, you know, stimulatory, maybe a little bit more norepinephrine type effect. You know, how true is that, and how does that play out in clinical practice? you know, I think of a patient that, you know, we may not get much more bang for your buck on increasing mirtazapine to the higher dosage range, you know, 30 to 60 milligrams in patients that we're treating insomnia. Now, genetics can play a role and all sorts of different stuff can play a role in what may or may not impact that medication, but you will see that reported out there in the literature. With any antidepressant, it's super important to educate our patients that for the antidepressant effect, it's likely going to take a while. You know, a few weeks, a couple weeks for sure to start displaying effects, but, you know, maybe up to 4 to 8 weeks before really starting to kick in. So definitely important to educate your patients in that respect. Now, if we're using it primarily for sleep, insomnia, and that effect, that should be seen fairly quickly, okay? Upon taking the first dose or first few doses, we should get that sedative type effect if that patient is going to have that effect and benefit from that. One other quirk on the adverse effect profile. So if you remember mirtazapine and bupropion, which I think I still need to cover in an upcoming episode here, but mirtazapine and bupropion tend to have a lot less impact on sexual dysfunction. So the SSRIs, SNRIs, the TCAs, those classes of medications tend to have a lot more problems with causing sexual dysfunction. So I think that's a really important differentiator and a good thing to remember. I've definitely remember seeing that throughout pharmacy school show up on different exams and quiz questions. Let's take a really quick break here. I want to remind you guys of three things. So reallifepharmacology.com, subscribers to the website. What I do is I send out an email once a week when the new podcast is out. But for subscribing, I'm giving you guys a free 31-page PDF on the top 200 drugs, okay? So really cool resource. Basically, what I did was pulled out the clinical pearls that I see in practice and really listed three things kind of for each of those medications in the top 200 that I think are most important. Certainly not to say that there isn't other things, but those really highly testable pearls with those medications. So that's free for subscribing at reallifepharmacology.com. Meded101.com/store. If you go to that link, you'll find stuff for pharmacists, nurse practitioners, physicians, med students. Our focus is mostly on pharmacists at this time. We're looking to expand that. But meded101.com/store, you can certainly check out our NAPLEX and BCPS and some of our great pharmacist resources. But like I said, we're looking to expand some of those other resources on pharmacology as well. And last, very quickly here, if you love us, go check us out. Leave us a rating and review on iTunes. Greatly, greatly appreciate it. And thank you to those who are listening and have already done so. So let's get back into it. We're talking about drug interactions with mirtazapine. And there aren't a lot that specifically come to mind, at least in my mind right away when I think about mirtazapine. Probably the biggest thing that first pops into my head is the CNS depressant effect. So that sedation, obviously if a patient's on other medications that can cause sedation, opioids, other psych medication, over-the-counter older antihistamines, all sorts of, you know, sleepers, other medications like that, that mirtazapine can kind of have that cumulative effect where it may zonk a person out even more or make them too sedated. Second thing with drug interactions, there is some issues through CYP1A2 and 3A4 and 2D6. So those CYP enzymes, as far as interactions goes, do play a role here. I would say that, you know, I'm not aware of any strong contraindications to any meds kind of through those pathways, but I would strongly encourage you to look that up if you do start a new medication, just to recognize which way concentrations might go. If it's increasing mirtazapine, if it's reducing concentrations, or if it's, you know, changing the concentrations of other medications as well. So think about that with mirtazapine and really clinical monitoring of patients with any new medication is going to be important, but keep in mind concentrations could be a little bit altered with mirtazapine in combination with other drugs. Serotonin type effects, so we've got to think about, you know, SSRIs and things of that nature. That can be an issue. I would say it's pretty low chance that there's any type of serotonin syndrome or stuff like that. You're going to have to look at that patient and kind of assess what other drugs they're on, what doses are they on, and that mirtazapine potentially having a small cumulative effect to that serotonergic load. A couple things that I think kind of are important for all antidepressants, and I did talk about, if you go listen to the SNRI podcast, I talked about discontinuation syndrome. So this is basically symptoms creeping up if a patient abruptly discontinues their antidepressant too quickly, basically without tapering down. So a very important point about antidepressants, being careful if we do have a patient that we're trying to get off, or, you know, the patient wants to go off themselves, important education point there. And one other thing that I haven't touched on much is switching antidepressants. So many times I've seen patients try SSRIs, maybe try an SNRI, and maybe it's still not working for depression, and we want to try something different. And mirtazapine, you know, might fit that bill depending upon the clinical situation. Now, with that, there's always a question, or I've gotten the question a lot, about how do we go from one antidepressant to the other. Let's say the one we're on, let's say it's sertraline, is not working and we want to go to another one. I generally recommend a cross taper where we start, you know, at a low dose of the mirtazapine and then at the same time come down slightly on the dose of, you know, sertraline or whatever other antidepressant you're using. So that's my preferred method. Now, if you've got a situation where you've got some serious adverse effect or something like that, you know, you're going to want to stop that drug right away and probably just have to deal with the discontinuation syndrome. But if, you know, patient's just not responding well, but they're tolerating it fine, I generally support cross tapering as far as just the most kind of conservative way to start a new antidepressant and kind of taper off the one they're on. Now, augmentation might be appropriate where we use two different antidepressants as well. So it's really kind of a clinical gray area as far as some of that goes. And I'm not going to get into that today, but just wanted to lay out that cross tapering strategy in theory, and at least from my experience, what I've seen providers and others do. I think that wraps up today's episode. Certainly hope you enjoyed the podcast. Hope you picked up a pearl or two. And leave us a review on iTunes if you have a second. If you've got questions, concerns, issues, maybe I misspoke, which is entirely possible, reallifepharmacology.com, and hit the contact button. It's the best and easiest way to get a hold of me. So take care. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a great rest of your day. Eric Christensen, PharmD, signing off. Take care.